The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation.
I will now read to you the most important part of the label.
Okay.
Fruity finale. Full stop.
Okay. I mean, we could talk about why that might be.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. My name is Quincy Parker. I am incredibly excited to join you once again, to have you join me and my partner in this endeavor as we podcast our way through the Scotch offerings available here in these sunny Isles of June. Partner, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Well, for various reasons. One, I don't think I'm very interesting in that sort of superficial way. The other reason is because I don't respond well to, like, off-the-cuff solicitations of that sort. Another one is, well, this guy is at Zuro. Why is a crooked letter?
How did you just, like, tell us your name?
Oh, that's not what you asked me. My name is Matthew B. Kelly. And I am pleased to be here with my colleague and friend, who is also a pond skipper, a puddle jumper.
You refer, of course, to my recent sojourn on the other side of the Atlantic.
Which I was immensely happy for you for.
I too, was immensely happy for myself. I will.
The only time I'm going to be happier is when I go.
Let me tell you, my brother, I am going to arm you with such information so that when you land, you will be able to maximize your enjoyment of the magnificence of the city of London, Londinium, Londonwick, all of its names from history. I had such a blast, Matthew. I really did.
Well, one of the first pictures I got was a whiskey house.
The Whiskey Exchange.
Oh.
I talked about it a little bit on the last pod. I talked about the fact that I have been reading the writings of the people from the Whiskey Exchange ever since I started drinking single malt whiskeys back in 2001.
BC.
Yeah, not BC. I mean, I'm old, but I'm not that old, bro. you know? So the Whiskey Exchange is, it's a London-based operation. And, you know, in addition to two stories of incredible single malt and blended whiskey offerings, they also have a really amazing tradition of writing. They literature on whiskeys. They write about history, they write about technique, they write about production, and they have a really solid track record in terms of ratings and rankings of not just whiskeys, but all manner of spirits. But their whiskey ratings and rankings are accepted almost, you know, universally as not only fair and accurate, but sort of, I don't know what the word is, they're right on point, as we would say, you know. So I'm walking along the Strand, and I say to myself, I want to buy some whiskey. I go to Google, and Google whiskey shops near me, and what pops up but the Whiskey Exchange?
All right.
It was a 3-minute walk from where I was at the time. And so what started off as a serendipitous, hey, I'd like to buy a bottle of whiskey, absolutely became a pilgrimage. Abso-frickin-lutely, buddy. I was like, there is no way in the universe I am not going to the Whiskey Exchange to go buy me a bottle, at least a bottle of whiskey. And the bottles that I bought were the Loch Lomond 18, which is their whiskey of the year. And I bought a bottle of the Glenturret Triple Wood, which is the bottle that we are going to be trying together today. And I'm a huge fan of Glenturret. It's a really, really small distillery. Like, really small. They literally have two stills, right? They have the fermentation still and the aging still. That's it. They put out, maybe 30, 40,000 cases of whiskey a year, which is minuscule when you talk about, you know, Glenlivet, for instance, with their 700,000 cases a year, you know. So this is a really small, intimate operation. It's actually Scotland's oldest working distillery, oldest licensed working distillery, was licensed in 1763. And I want to be clear, and I'm not saying it's the oldest distillery just because there are older distilleries, but they did not get licensed. So they were operating illegally. And Glenturret was the first to actually be licensed to operate as a distillery to make Scotch whiskey. And yeah, 1763 was not a mistake. That's the date that they got licensed. That's how old this whiskey is and this industry is. Or at least this whiskey making method. And so it's a great story. You can look it up. One of the things that I think is incredible is their master distiller is a guy named Bob Dalgarno. Bob Dalgarno used to be a master distiller at the Macallan. He worked there for like 30 years and then he retired. And when the new owners of the Glenturret let it be known what they were trying to do, he came out of retirement to work with them. And he is creating these incredible whiskeys with them. And as for what they're trying to do, you know, before we started recording, I was telling you, this company, this distillery, used to be owned by Edrington, which is the charity company that owns the Macallan, Highland Park, the Glenrothes, the famous Grouse. We've tasted these scotches, right? They used to own the Glenturret as well. They sold it. They bought it back. And then they sold it again a couple of years ago because it's so small. And they can't. They didn't want to over-commercialize it, but they also wanted to really spend a lot of time and energy and focus on the Macallan brand. So they put this up for auction. And the people who bought it, the new owners, are the owner and the second largest shareholder in the Lalique Crystal Company. They are the ones who won the bid, and not because they had the highest bid, but because they were the ones who committed to distilling this whiskey in a zero carbon footprint way, and not through buying trees or planting trees in rainforests, but through actually trying to change the fermentation and distillation process to have zero carbon footprint. And, you know, that spoke to the Edrington people. It also spoke to Bob Delgarno to have the challenge to make this whiskey in a carbon neutral way, but have it taste incredible and have what is in the bottle be still the star of the show while the process to get there does not create a harmful effect on the world around us.
In so, that case, mm-hmm. I invite you to do the thing.
You know, we haven't seen each other in a little bit. So
right. So I don't know why you're making me wait.
I'm not. I'm, ladies and gentlemen, anyway, I'm going to tell everybody. I can leave that alone. What I was trying to say, Matthew, was that if
life
you,
is short, man.
If you wish, you can do the thing. I was gonna say, why don't you do the thing this time? So, why don't you do the thing? I see why you don't do the thing.
For the listening audience, I have done the thing.
I see why you don't do the thing.
And, you know, that's not a splash that I that I did not enjoy. That's a
wow. Okay. Okay. So today we are tasting the Glenturret Triple Wood. And the reason it's called a triple wood is because the wood that it is aged in is treated in three separate ways. So it's all oak barrels, of course, but in one oak barrel, it's sherry, American oak, then the other is French oak sherry, and the third is American oak that had bourbon in it. So they call it triple wood, which is technically not true because it's all American oak or French oak, so there's only really two woods, but it's three different styles of treatment of the wood that gives them the justification for calling it the triple wood. And, you know, as a no-age statement whiskey, which means, you know, it's not one of these that you call like an 18-year-old or a 12-year-old or whatever, it's a single malt, which means that all of the malts that are in this whiskey are distilled in the same distillery. But there are different malts that have been blended together to create this single malt, and that's where the complexity and the niceness, for lack of a better word, comes from. You've had significant time to get the smell, and what is the nose saying to you?
So I'm getting that sort of caramel. The tasting notes on the bottle indicate toffee, which I'll say that I'm not like picking that up strongly on the nose, but certainly somewhere between that and caramel, but not very strong. Something that strikes me is this definite apple. I feel green, but not like fresh.
Maybe baked?
Sorry?
Maybe a baked apple?
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense at all, but what popped into my head is an aged apple.
Okay. Okay.
And then
aged apple. All right.
I'm getting wood notes, but nothing that I could particularly identify. So, you know, and we'll see how that is on the tongue.
Yeah.
In just a little bit, and
As we're doing the nosing, one of the things that I came across most recently was a different take on how to do the nosing of a single malt whiskey, or any whiskey really, or any strong spirit.
I'm listening.
You know, the Macallan guy that we spoke to, Reed Parker, talked, you know, and showed a much more direct stick your nose in the glass type technique. But I spoke to a gentleman, Joffrey Markle, who is a whiskey consultant in the region, and his technique is, you know, to hold the glass a good 6 inches or so away from your nose and let the aroma come to you, as opposed to sticking your nose right in there. Because what happens with the really strong whiskeys or strong spirits is that the alcohol blows out all of your olfactory senses. So if you stick your nose right in there, all you're going to do is inhale a bunch of alcohol, so you can't really smell any of the other aromas anyway. So maybe find a comfortable distance between having your nose stuck straight in and, you know, a little, about six inches or so away from your nose.
Yeah, and I've seen people advocate sort of going between.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole discussion around, well, no, the whole idea about what is affecting what in the olfactory senses, and, you know, which volatiles you're more likely to pick up at which distances, et cetera, you know, it's mm-hmm. it at the end of the day. It is interesting. It's a bit of an art as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But my recommendation to a newbie being now promoted to a neophyte is that you should don't overthink it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Joffrey and I had a conversation also. In the same conversation, forgive me, we also talked about something that you like to do, the drop of water.
Yeah.
Right? Which he recommended a single drop,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to a couple of drops. And his reasoning was scientific, right? The chemicals that the water is reacting with after the single drop, it's as if they are like metal filings to a magnet, right? They become uniform in their attraction to the water, and that's why you get all of those different flavorings at the same time. If you put in too much water, then it just muddies up the whole process. And by the same token, after you put your drop of water in, you're not supposed to stir it up. You're supposed to just drop the water in, let those chemicals do their thing, and then taste.
Right. I don't remember ever mixing myself.
No, I'm not talking about you. I'm saying I've seen people who put the water in and then stir it up and think that they are enhancing their drinking experience.
Right. No, sorry. I wasn't sort of trying to say that you had accused me of that. But I've definitely, the recommendation I have seen around is pretty much that, with a little bit of leeway with people saying definitely no more than three, but the preference being one.
Yeah. To me, I having done a lot of tasting with and without the drop of water, I personally just prefer it without. I know that the aficionados really do recommend that drop of water to open up all the flavors. But for whatever reason, that just doesn't appeal to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm a neophyte. Maybe I'm a... No, not neophyte is not the right word. Troglodyte.
Yeah, maybe you disdain froofiness.
Maybe I'm a caveman, whatever, you know. I do disdain froofiness, unless that froofiness is a nice fountain pen. So I guess it's time to taste. First impressions.
Slight vanilla. I am particularly interested sometimes in the mouthfeel of these things, right? This is this is soft. Doesn't stay that way once the burn wakes up a little bit, which is a very slight, mellow, quite a pleasant way. You know, I'm surprised the apple doesn't come forth a little bit more. It's the same for me as it was on the nose. And the wood tones are quite subdued. Mm-hmm. This overall is a very sort of, hello, welcome home, have a seat, turn on that music, and let's just breathe for a while. You know, as some of these other ones are like, crackling fire, cozy up, and I'll tell you a story.
Mm-hmm.
So, I find that quite pleasant. Now, the thing is, right, I'm going to guess that the price point on this is not going to make this a sort of casual... go to break it out for someone you see every other day sort of whiskey.
Okay. I mean, that's a fair assumption. Keep in mind, I did get it in London, so the price.
You did, but it is pretty small distillery.
It's a teeny weeny distillery.
Lalique is.
This bottle
principles
is,
yeah,
the bottle
involved.
Itself is modeled by, I mean, it's made by Lalique in terms, sorry, it's designed by Lalique, but this is not a Lalique crystal bottle.
No,
to
I
be
mean,
clear.
It seems, it's just, quite a nice bottle.
It's a nice bottle, but it's not Lalique crystal. If it was Lalique crystal, then it would cost $6,000 like the Macallan M, which is in a Lalique crystal decanter. This is this probably sits between $50 to $70, maybe $80 at Jimmy's Wines and Spirits. I think Jimmy's carries a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old. Look, a 7 and a 10. I know they also have a 12-year-old, which I think they're going to start carrying soon. I don't know who else in town would have it, but I know it's there.
I have to say I'm a little bit surprised. Yeah. Pleasantly.
Mm-hmm. You would think it's more expensive than that.
Yeah.
It may become more expensive as time passes. But I think the most you would pay for this particular bottle is $70 to $80.
Okay.
Yeah. Now my initial response is kind of similar to yours in terms of the first thing I noticed was the mouthfeel. Even before the flavors announced themselves, the way it felt on the tongue, you know, in the mouth was, the words I wrote down were round, buttery, and smooth.
Yes. So I'm trying to bring more of a concrete description of what I mean by smooth sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that like it just... It literally felt soft
as
it coated.
Mm-hmm. Reed would talk about, that's the Macallan guy, would talk about the oils coming from the wood, you know, that during the aging process, that,
sure,
you know, and all of this, that, and the next. And the science is fascinating, no doubt. But after that roundness, what I get is, yes, there's the subtle sweetness. I'll give you caramel. I'll give you your baked apple, but I'm feeling, and maybe, you know, our taste buds are all different, but I get a hint of citrus as well, which I find interesting. And a very, very light smokiness. I could call the smokiness woodiness, and it's almost hitting those same, you know, those are usually two very different components in a flavor profile for me, but whatever is in this flavor combination, it's stroking both of those at the same time. So I'm liking it a lot. I agree with you. It's a very comforting drink, which I think might be problematic because, you know, you just sit out and sip and sip and sip, and before you know it, you've gone through a whole bottle. I don't know if that's how you get down, but if that's how you get down, then, you know, more power to you. This, I'm going to ask you a little later, and I want you to be thinking about this while we have our conversation, about this and the list. And given that we are into the seventh month of the year, the first half of the year is gone, so I would like to conclude our conversation today with a review of the list, and I guess maybe sort of a double checking, making sure that what is on the list belongs there after some time for reflection and thought, after having tasted, you know, the things that we've tasted in between those times and now.
Fair enough.
Okay.
We could review the list.
Before we do that, though,
what small things have been happening in the world, Quincy?
The Bahamas turned 51 last week. What are your thoughts on the 51st anniversary of the independence of the Commonwealth of the Bahamas?
I'm going to give brief commentary by saying that I don't have much to say, which I think says a lot in and of itself.
And
go ahead.
I'm going to challenge your reticence and demand that you verbalize your critique, which is a very layered and subtle, more sometimes is left unsaid than goes said type critique. So I'm asking you to put words to that, or at least that's what I read it as. So I'm asking you to put words to it so that I do not misunderstand and that I know what you think so I can interact with it pretty pleased with sugar and cherries on top.
If I could be succinct.
Can you be any other way?
I could be terribly verbose and rambling even.
I defy you.
Why do you wish the listener such pain? The general position that I have is that we're doing pretty darn well despite ourselves. You know, there are some rather silly decisions that we make, albeit perhaps there's some small set of people. Sometimes they're the people who we put to supposedly represent us. We'll be making these decisions. Sometimes it's our simple negligence of our duties, etc. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot to be thankful for. At 51 as a country, I think it is lamentable that we seem to have a very short public memory. We don't, in my estimation, have a strong vision and strategy. But I don't think that we have made decisions that would even allow us to do that yet. Like, what the hell do we even want as a country? You know, and how we can come to terms with how such a decision can be made on behalf of the people. These are things that I'm a little bit sad about. But, you know, I'm not going to call any particular country's name. We're just not doing as poorly in a lot of ways than a lot of other people. And I think that that is good. The primary thing is to not backslide and live to dream another day, I think. You know, there are times when the gung-ho energy of progress is with you, and right now is not one of them with me. You know, maybe check me for 52.
Well, I mean, thank God, if the universe wills it, we'll be here for 52, right? I agree with you that on balance, all is not lost. And that we've made a decent amount of progress, especially at the macro level. You know, individual families have, over the last 51 years, created paradigm shifts in their circumstances that have... A family member once during family debate during, you know, the Christmas holidays, it was like two generations ago we were in the bush, and now look at us as a family, right? And I wonder. I had a conversation on a couple of days ago at an event with two, you know, interested, committed, caring young Bahamian men who are, you know, less than 40 years old. And, you know, our conversation was about the state of affairs in the country at large. You know, it started with a particular area and moved to a general commentary and questioning about what it is that's real in the Bahamas right now. And at 51, one of the things that I feel some degree of concern about is the atomization that has happened in our country. Just across the time that I have grown up, my family moved to the house that my parents occupied in Sanssouci in 1977 when my brother Neil was born. And we've lived there as a family since 1977. And I grew up knowing practically every child on my street, the street to the left and the street to the right, plus Camperdown Drive, plus some streets up and around, right? Because I used to roam, as we all did. We used to be up and down in each other's houses. We would sleep over. We would play. We would have group play dates. We didn't call them play dates, of course, but that's, you know. And I have watched as economic progress and quote-unquote climbing the economic ladder has reduced the circle of people with whom you interact. In my parents' generation, you know, they could truly talk about community, right? I think at 51 now, I am maybe the last person, people my age are sort of the last Bahamians who could genuinely talk about anybody, any adult on the street growing up, where you lived growing up, could take a belt to your backside if they caught you misbehaving. At the same time, any adult on the street where you lived growing up would also feed you if it was mealtime and you were within their sphere of influence. I don't think that that kind of community exists anymore by and large. It may exist in pockets, but it's not a feature of the Bahamas as it would have been, in my view. And I'm probably wrong because, you know, we all interpret the world through our own lenses, but that's genuinely what I believe. And I'm concerned about that atomization because what it means is we don't know each other. I knew my neighbors' names. I knew the names of people in my community. I don't think that people living on the same street I grew up on know each other's names anymore. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that that is a loss of protection. It's a loss of common aspiration. It's a loss of so many different things. And I don't know how we would go about getting that back if that were a thing we were interested even in recovering. So atomization and loss of community is something that I'm concerned about at 51 years of age for the Bahamas. I'm also concerned about, and this is something that we've talked about on the show, our education culture. Right? I continue to say it. When you go to school in countries that have strong cultural identities, the first thing you learn is why that country is great. They don't say it in those terms. They talk about history. You go to school in America, you learn American history as you are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Right? You go to school in the UK, you learn UK history. You go to school in Germany, you learn German history. You go to school in everywhere else in the world that has a strong cultural identity, you learn your country's history as you are learning and becoming yourself. So that you, I think the psychology, and you can speak to this, is that you find yourself in your country's story. And you assume ownership of that story as you find yourself in it. But in Bahamian schools, we learn world history. We don't even really learn regional history. I mean, in social studies, you might have read about Three Finger Jack and the Maroons, but you don't know nothing but Barbados or Grenada. You don't know nothing but St. Vincent and the Grenadines or St. Kitts and Nevis and Antigua and Barbados. You don't know nothing about your neighbors. But you know a little bit about Africa, a lot about Europe, and a ton about old Europe in particular. And maybe a little bit about America too. And I think that culture in education is something that education ministers have continued to try to address. I don't know how many curriculum reform agendas have been passed since A.D. Hanna was a minister of education back in the 1970s. But our curriculum has yet to reflect the idea that the Bahamas is a culture worth studying, and that Bahamian history is important for Bahamian children to know. I see you have thoughts.
Yeah, well, I wonder what the current curriculum is. I have an inkling that the curriculum that I went through, you know, we're not that far apart, but I think that it did change between when you were in primary school and when I was in primary school. I'm not saying a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I would be interested to know where it is right now. About, I would say 10 years ago, I learned of, okay, someone claimed something very disturbing to me. That I can't remember which school book it was in, but there was the claim that there was overt overt messaging that you serve the tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And the exact word, and I can't remember. It wasn't disturbing at first to me. It was laughable because I couldn't conceive that that would be the truth. It certainly wasn't the truth when I went to primary school. However, I found myself in Book World and Stationers, and I decided, oh, let me just look. And it was indeed the case. And I was, for about third grade, I was supremely disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know the curriculum now, but I think past evidence is sufficient to support what you're saying. I also, unfortunately, know some of the, just at a very long distance, but I know some of the workings of the Ministry of Education. And it is not in a particularly good place to make the changes that you are saying right now. I will make that assertion.
Mm-hmm.
I will renege on one's duty to give evidence to support.
Mm. I think that's fair.
But at the same time,
I think that's fair.
Here's the thing. I don't think that schools are negligible in
negligent.
No. I mean that their contribution is negligible.
Okay, cool.
In the creation of culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that they are primary either. The other inputs into how children are enculturated, I think, are more important. And unfortunately, they're more difficult to implement changes with. The home life, you know, the parents, what they think, whether or not they are encouraging in curiosity or not, and which ideas they expose the children to or do not, etc. I think that's far more important.
I agree with that, actually. But I think it's almost a which came first, the chicken or the egg question. Because the parents have to have a message with which to work, right? They have to have information that they want to pass on.
Right.
They have to have a culture in which they believe that they are wanting to inculcate into their children.
Right, and I don't think they would, even if that was structured into school, I don't think that that's going to be the defining factor as to if they carry that into adulthood.
But that's where they spend the most of their time, though, isn't it?
I hope not.
Most of us spent most of our time while we were school aged, most of our awake time.
Okay, if you take
most of our conscious time.
Fair enough if you take consciousness away. However, right? The impact of the home life, because of the relationship between the children and the family, mm-hmm. however it's structured, right, is just stronger.
I agree.
It gives
I agree 100%.
A stronger imprint. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, well, how do you get the home family, the whole, I want to say parents, right? But in a lot of cases, it's the grandparents or the uncle, mm-hmm. auntie, or whatever, right?
Parental influence, let's say.
To let's say, improve these are tough subjects, man. Sometimes you just got to take a break yourself and recharge and not contemplate the mysteries of the universe.
I hear you.
Which is not something that I say very often. Yeah. But man.
No, this is the beauty of the Sunday Scotch Society, right? We are providing public service in guiding our fellow dipsomaniacs to a place where they can enjoy with knowledge and information to deepen their enjoyment of a nice sip of spirits while they contemplate whatever they choose to contemplate instead of the difficulties and craziness that so often afflict and beset us during the week, right? But I guess that also gives a great opportunity for us to get back to our conversation. I really wanted to talk to you about what the U.S. said about the Bahamas this week.
Oh, really? What new drama is afoot?
They say that the Davis administration is stalling on the full enactment of anti-corruption legislation.
Oh, okay. It's their turn to do that, eh?
Yeah, particularly they're talking about campaign finance reform, the promised integrity commission, uh-huh. and of course, more than a decade of failure to enforce the Public Disclosure Act.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. It's almost a job of the U.S. to point that out, yeah?
This is actually not almost. This is in the context of their investment suitability sort of survey that they provide for American businesses. Mm-hmm. So it is actually the job of the State Department.
Right. Yes. So,
not necessarily to call the Bahamas corrupt, which you're not doing, by the way.
No.
But to comment on the suitability of the jurisdiction for the investor, right. And their safety and their ability to make a good living.
Right. So this is part of the operations checklist.
Yes.
Blah blah blah. We have to say this. Boom boom boom.
My next question.
Yeah. No. I'm not saying that they have to make it up. I'm just mm-hmm. saying like this has to be done. So it's going to happen. The U.S. is going to say this thing.
Yes.
Right. Because it's the case.
As long as we have not enacted Fine. These laws, they yeah, will exactly. absolutely make that statement. Yes.
Right. Right. So
my question really isn't about the U.S.
Right. Right. But just answer this before we move on. Mm-hmm. So is this administration going to implement that?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Okay.
That's the point of the critique. The point of the critique is, you asked me, so let me speak. The point of the critique is you made a commitment to enact certain legislation.
Mm-hmm.
You made a commitment to adhere to certain of your own laws. That commitment is enshrined in our plan. That commitment was made on the floor of the House of Assembly. That commitment mm-hmm. was made in any kind, any number of public statements.
Mm-hmm.
Up to this point, you have not yet done as you committed to do.
Yes.
That is the U.S.'s statement, which provides for the Bahamian press an opportunity to simply say to the administration, when will you follow through on mm-hmm. this commitment?
Mm-hmm.
The administration has then the opportunity to say, we will enact said law on said date.
Mm, yes.
They have not said that.
Right, because they have the opportunity to say it, but they're not
obligated to say anything.
Obligated to say it.
Unless the voting public makes it an issue, as they have with medical marijuana.
Yeah. Here's the thing, man. Like, with certain of these political issues, right? I just don't even see the point in discussing it sometimes. You know, I'm a moody fellow sometimes. You know what I mean?
Are you? I never would have noticed.
Noted, sir. But between me and you, right? And just the one person on the other side
mm-hmm.
of this mic, hearing us through the speaker.
Oh, it's so much more than one. Okay.
It's just you, me, and the listener.
Right.
Mm. We know. We know. Okay. The Davis administration is not going to do it. But I'm not calling them out because it's the Davis administration. Should there be a Pintard administration? The Pintard administration is not going to do it. And if Bahamian politics stays to pattern and there's another complete swing after the FNM wins the next time, if it happens, I'm not saying it will, but you know, there's a pattern, and unless something happens to interrupt it, it will probably persist for a while in oscillation. The one after that, they're not. They're like, look at me.
Here's my problem with what you're saying.
I know you have a problem, but just look at me.
I'm looking at you, Quincy. I'm looking deeply at you.
Listen to me, listener.
I'm hearing you.
Right? Mm. Between the three of us.
You, me, and the listener.
We know. They're not going to do it.
So.
And so. So we could complain about it.
So no.
But let's see if what it is.
We don't know that they're not going to do it.
Really?
And here's how we don't know that they're not going to do it. If you and I had been having this conversation in 2013, 2014, and you and I were talking about the implementation of a value-added tax, the first external overt tax to be implemented in Bahamian history, you would no doubt be looking me in the eye and saying, we know they're not going to do it. They're not going to implement a tax. What do you get this to the Bahamas? The whole point of the Bahamas is we don't have taxes. We know they're not going to do it.
Well, see, that's where I disagree. Because I think that the set of pressures for that to come about. You know, so maybe this is hindsight.
There's no maybe about it. It is definitively hindsight.
I don't think so. Because
I was in the press during that time.
Right, but you didn't talk to me. You said you. And I know you didn't mean you, Matthew.
I did mean you, Matthew.
Okay.
Because well, you said it's you, me, and the listener.
Yeah, that's fine. Listener?
Mm-hmm.
I really hope he's not accusing you. I will bear this one for all of us.
Okay.
I am pretty darn sure you pull my wife aside and you ask her what I thought pre-vat when all the discussion was starting to happen. I would not say, see, we know
we
they're not going to do this.
We're about to run out of time.
But I will say, with disclosures and just being...
But they did it in 2011.
Accountable.
The Public Disclosure Commission printed the report in 2011 of all those cabinet ministers and senior public servants who by law are mandated to report who did not do so. So it is not as if they have never done it.
Right. And they learned a lesson.
if you wish to see it that way, that's one way to see it. But I refuse to accept the we know they're not going to do it. I refuse to accept that. I understand that that may be your position.
I accept that I could be wrong, right? If you were going to make a bet.
I don't know that you really do.
If you were going to make a bet. Strongly recommend.
You may have better odds than
I do. Where the money is.
Yeah, your odds are probably going to be stronger than mine. But honestly, I have to believe that at some point, anyway, the list. So what we agreed was that that scotches or spirits that we felt were a cut above, extraordinary, that had something unique and fascinating and whatever, they would be put upon a list that we accept is arbitrary. We accept that there are all manner of caveats to be given and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, we determined that the Sunday Scotch Society would have a list of its top 10 for every year. And the list so far, in no order of, you know, precedence, is the Macallan 18-year-old Sherry Oak, orange and dried fruit candy, almond and buttermilk in the nose, a kiss of sunshine, I believe one of us said. It sounds more like you than me. The sip was brown sugar and candied fruit and nut, banana and coconut, white pepper and cinnamon. The list score for the Macallan 18-year-old Sherry Oak. Quincy gave it 5 of 5. I would have given it 6 out of 5 if I could. Matthew gave it 4.8 out of 5.
Always room for improvement.
Always room for improvement. The next thing that was put on the list was the Naked Malt. I don't know if you remember the Naked Malt. If you don't remember it, it probably needs to get struck off the list. But it is the one that is a blend of the Macallan, the Glenrothes, and the Highland Park. The bottle with no label on it. And it was delicious. But since you don't remember it, it is now no longer.
No one said that I don't remember it.
Oh, okay, good. This is a problem. Anyway, the next thing on the list is the High West Double Rye. We did not give that one scores, which I apologize to the listener for. And I don't want to go back and try to score it retroactively. Because that seems unfair. So I think the appropriate question is... does Does the Glen Turret Triple Wood make the list, in your view?
I know this is unfair.
Oh, dear.
Because as we go along, my criteria are just getting stricter.
No worries. That's the job.
And while I would highly recommend this whiskey,
Okay. Thank you very much for your time and energy as usual, Matthew. I feel like the Glen Turret Triple Wood was a nice way to spend an afternoon catching up. And I look forward to the Loch Lomond for the next time.
Ciao.
Nazvidanya.
Check it out.